2022, the United Nations General Assembly requests that the ICJ to give a non-binding opinion of the legal consequences of the Israeli occupation. Monday was the final day of the hearings at The Hague. Will the ruling really make a difference? Well, we're going to look at this on the Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Jonathan Puttop, international lawyer out of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. And Kim Sharif, activist and lawyer out of London. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let me start it off in Lancaster and Jonathan. The ICJ is expected to take 6 months to issue its order. Let's start off here. Why? Why does it take 6 months?
Well, these are 15 judges who are jurists in their own right. By sitting on the World Court, they cannot write articles for or books or for journals. So when there's a serious issue like this, they want to think about it thoroughly and write a detailed decision with the basis for the decision almost as important as the decision itself. So the ICJ always takes months and months, sometimes years, to reach an opinion. And if there are different opinions, if each justice wants to write their own twist on the conclusion, it does take time, yes.
Okay, well, Kim, I mean, is it difficult to determine if the Zionist regime's occupation is illegal or not?
Yes, good evening to you, Ms. Marcia, and your guest has helpfully explained the situation. No, I mean, anyone watching the case, you don't have to be a lawyer to understand that this is an open and shut case. I mean, I would refer people to the presentations of the lawyer for the Arab League, who was a formidable guy who really clarifies everything legally from the beginning to now. And that shows you that this is an open and shut case, doesn't need that much time. Especially in light of the current urgency that is taking place in Gaza itself, where at least 500 people are being killed a day, and mostly women and children. And that is really disgusting. It's extermination of people. We said years ago, never again. Never again must surely mean in relation to all humans, not just some humans and not others. And so I don't understand. I mean, I can accept that they need the time. I can accept that they are required by law and morally required to give reasoning for their judgment. And I expect them to be reviewing the written submissions of all the countries and organizations again to make sure that whatever reasoning they give is based on evidence and legal arguments presented to them rather than their own personal opinions. So, yes, to that extent, I can see why they need 6 months. But from an ordinary layperson's perspective, this shouldn't take a long time. It's an open and shut case. You don't have to be a lawyer to see that there is an immediate urgency that requires immediate decision rather than prolonged taking time. At least make an interim order. At least make an interim order. But in relation to the opinion, I expect it to take as long as they had stated because of the reasons I have just explained and our colleague over there, Jonathan, explained to you as well. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, Jonathan, there are some experts who believe that these moves by the ICJ is an attempt by the court to exert more sovereignty and move away from American hegemony. How do you see it?
Well, in a way, this case, together with the other case before the ICJ, is a challenge to international law itself, to the system of laws that has been created mostly at the end of World War II, which has been failing the majority of the population of this planet. Initially, international law was created largely by European and American and Western countries to regulate the world in a certain way. Now, people in the South, people in the Third World, developing countries, now are saying, okay, if international law is to be followed, it needs to address our needs, not just the needs of the powerful. And occupation is one of these issues. Occupation was to be a temporary state of affairs where some people, wherever there's a war, and some population falls under the occupation of the army of another country, it's supposed to be a temporary state of affair until peace comes and you restore the situation to the way it used to be before. Now, this occupation has been taking place for more than 50 years. And not only that, but Israel has not been following the Geneva Conventions and the Hague Conventions relating to protection of civilians under occupation. So some scholars started saying, well, this is no longer a belligerent occupation. This is actually itself an illegal occupation. This is not just a temporary thing that happened at the end of war. It's now becoming a permanent feature with no end in sight that looks more like annexation, that looks more like control and rule rather than a temporary belligerent occupation. That is why the case was brought. Please explain to us, what is this strange status? Is the occupation itself, has it become illegal because it's been for so long and because of the practices of Israel during the occupation, has rendered this no longer a belligerent occupation and a temporary state of affairs, but an actual de facto annexation?
Well, Kim, there are other experts who point out that the whole liberal system of which these international organizations are part of were created to protect U.S. hegemony, and that's what they continue to do. Your thoughts on that side of things?
Well, indeed, it is very hard to rebut that suggestion in light of what we have seen going on over the years since the creation of the UN to date. We haven't seen the Security Council, for example, being used as a platform for promotion of peace. We've seen it being used as a platform for warmongering, and lots of wars have taken place, illegal wars, albeit lots of them, and lots of genocides have been committed, and the Security Council has been dominated by what I term the bully boys, as I previously said, and you know who they are. And it is difficult to rebut the suggestion that this is about enabling the U.S. Regime to act as like an empire to the world, and therefore the rest of the world is just mere colonies of the U.S. empire. That can't surely be right, because you see, the Security Council itself is on par, is an organ of the U.N. institution as a whole, on par with the court, on par with the Human Rights Council. Therefore, it can't see itself as above all on the basis of the ownership of nuclear weapons by certain states. You see, because if we say that we accept that argument, then we're saying that we live in the jungle, and this is the rule of the jungle, might is right, and the rest of the world is just mere colonies of this mighty regime that needs to be followed. And that can't be right, because this regime is actually, the U.S. regime, is a rogue regime, quite frankly, because it does not comply with any rule of law. It seems to regard itself above all and above everything, and humans and everything, and aiding and abetting genocide in Gaza and elsewhere, illegal wars in Iraq and elsewhere. We can't accept this situation to continue, because the world contains more than one country. There are 193 countries, member states of the UN itself. And all these countries are now waking up to the reality that they are being treated as mere colonial slaves. Some countries are still paying colonial taxes, apparently, and that's completely shocking to the core. And there is an awakening taking place in the world, and I feel that. I feel that through the proceedings of the ICJ, as we have been watching up to today, as well as the upcoming case of the South African state that is against genocide. Now, under that case, once the court ruled that there is a prima facie case to answer against the charge of genocide, it is incumbent upon every country in the world. In fact, they are under a duty to act, and very quickly, to prevent and stop this genocide. But where are they? So, yes, the suggestion that this whole system has been kind of set up to empower and enable the rogue regime to take control of the world, it's difficult to rebut seeing what has been happening over the years, for the past 70 years, throughout the time that the UN has been in existence. And one more point, which is quite shocking to know, perhaps for some people, is this, that when the Statute of Rome came into existence and the court in Hague was established for enforcement of the principles of and rules of the Treaty of Rome, apparently the U.S. has passed a law that enables it, that demands or enables it to invade Holland in case anybody from the U.S. is ever brought to justice there for war crimes and crimes against humanity or genocide. So it is considering or treating itself above the law, above humanity, above everything. That can't surely be right. We're all equal. We're all humans. Look at the Charter. As the Charter speaks about equality, the Charter speaks about inalienable right to self-determination for peoples. Hmm. Why is this being denied to everybody? That's just ridiculous. Can't be sustained. This position cannot be sustained. It's not tenable. That's what I'm saying.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Right. Well, that was interesting, your point you made just now, Kim. And what about that, Jonathan? Because, yes, if we read so many of the charters, whether we're talking about the International Court of Justice or you're talking about the United Nations and so many of the other agencies that come under the United Nations, beautifully worded, talking about equality. But the reality is that we really have never seen that since 1945, of course, when most of these were established after World War II. So at this point in time, do you think that the ruling of the ICJ is really going to make a difference? Can it make a difference? Because at the end of the day, it's also non-binding.
Yes, I think it can make a big difference. The question is, how do other people react to it? If you remember, one of the first non-binding advisory opinion was in the case of Namibia, where the occupation of Namibia by South Africa, they couldn't stop that occupation. They tried to go through the Security Council, and of course the veto by England and the United States prevented it. So the General Assembly asked the ICJ for an advisory opinion. And that advisory opinion was that the occupation was illegal and that it is the duty of all states to bring an end to that illegal occupation. As a result, there was an international movement to boycott South Africa, and corporations stopped dealing with South Africa. Sports events stopped allowing South African teams to play. And there was an international pressure that in the end led to the independence of Namibia and later to the end of the apartheid regime in South Africa itself. So the question is not just what is the opinion of the ICJ, but what is the reaction of the governments and the people of the world to that opinion. I'd like to explain, even regular courts, national courts, don't have at their disposal enforcement mechanisms. The enforcement is largely voluntary. It has moral authority, and everybody is supposed to follow it. And anybody who refuses to follow the decisions of the court becomes something of an outlaw or a person who tries to be outside of what the society and the community wants. So in a real way, the decision of the ICJ is as powerful as is the political will of governments and people to abide by it.
Okay, well, that's an interesting point. Let me just start right there with Kim. So just according to what Jonathan is saying then, so it is as important as the governments that will abide by it. But we have seen over the years, and even now we're watching what is happening with the United States and the UK and some of the other other Western countries that are also hand in hand in this genocide. So we have seen that time and time again, those who wanted to stand up against these entities were sanctioned, punished, something had happened to them. So in general, do you think that we're at the point, because of this unbelievable genocide and what is taking place, that the countries of the world, Kim, are really willing to stand up against the United States, against the Western hegemony, against the Israeli regime, and the consequences that come with that?
I believe that is the case. I can feel it. I can see there is a movement of saying enough is enough. I mean, I have listened to the presentations made by the Colombian state, which was amazing, Namibian state, and many other states, and even Turkey. And it's amazing to see that in the first place that these countries got together and made this application to explore and debate this this issue as to the occupation, whether it is legal or not. And it turns out that it's actually not legal. The occupation from the beginning, from the Balfour Declaration, is illegal, ab initio illegal. And therefore, every action taken thereafter is also illegal. And so there's so many crimes have been committed. So to see these countries, and of course, the Indonesian state also made a very compelling representation. And to see all these countries getting together and the sanctions not working in as much as it used to many years ago. And also there are alternative economic scenes in the world platform today that are showing themselves to be credible forces to reckon with. I'm talking about BRICS. I'm talking about many other amazing movements taking place, the African Union. And many countries are waking up to the reality that they cannot allow the status quo to continue as it is, because it means effectively they are all being enslaved by one set of triads. I call them the dark triad, the dry triad, enslaving the rest of the world, because it's, what they're doing is purely colonialism. And the rest of the world is beginning to wake up to this and say, enough is enough. I feel that there is a change taking place, because you see, in some places, you're not even allowed to say from the river to the sea, which is a statement which is contained in the constitution of the Likud party itself. But if you say it as a non-Israeli person, you will be accused of being anti-Semite, even if you're an Arab like me. I'm a Semite myself. So you'll be accused of being anti-Semite. But having said that, to see that all these countries getting together, making this application, to see South Africa being moved by what's going on, making the application it made, I think we can start to feel that there is a movement of change taking place. And what we need to do is support that movement of change and perhaps even encourage our own countries to see the common sense of supporting such a movement of treating human beings as equal, rather than holding a racist, colonialist mindset in relation to this to the rest of the world. That can't continue. That can't be right. It's actually a stigma, an anathema on our reputation as a country ourselves here in the UK, with the history of slavery, with colonialism. You know, the cases of the Mau Mau is still coming up. You know, people being raped with a broken beer bottles and that kind of thing. The shame is still there. Let's not continue building more shame on us. That's what I'm trying to say. And okay. I feel that there is a movement in the world that is awakening, is that saying enough is enough.
Okay, Jonathan, do you agree with Kim? And in general, do you think that these hearings are indicative of a change globally and how countries are starting to see the Israeli regime?
Yes, I think it is true. And a large part of it is because the Israelis are not hiding what they're doing. The Holocaust that took place in Germany took place in the dark. People didn't even know until after the war about the horrors of what the Nazis were doing to the Jews. Here, it is open. You see it on the social media. You see it on television screens. There's only one place where you don't see it very well, and that's in Israel, where they don't show that on their screens. And in the United States, of course, the media is also biased. But this is a reality that people are seeing, and that the Israelis are not hiding themselves. They are open about what they are doing. And this is going to lead to a lot of changes in the world. You must understand that international law itself developed to a large degree as a result of ordinary people being fed up with the horrors of World War II and feeling the need to do something to create a new order where it's not just the powerful can do whatever they want. And in a real way, it has worked. For most world, the idea of taking over somebody else's country next to you because you had historic rights over it, or because you have a security interest.
Well, Jonathan, sorry to interrupt you here. Has it worked? I mean, you say in reality, okay, this came about after World War II because of a need for something better. Has it worked, or has it been unfair from the very beginning? We see which countries were, for example, with the International Court of Justice, which countries have been accused, which countries have not, which countries have actually committed unbelievable crimes since World War II, but no one dared to either try them, or no one actually paid the price for their crimes. So has it worked, or was it based on inequality from the very beginning?
It hasn't worked in all cases. It hasn't worked all the time, but it has largely worked. Let me explain why.
Okay.
If you look at the larger historical picture, between 1948 and today, there have only been about four or five cases where a country tried to expand its borders and annex nearby countries. One of them was Iraq and Kuwait. Another was Western Sahara. Another was the Ukraine. And another is Israel, annexing the Golan Heights and annexing East Jerusalem and trying to annex. But that's, very few out of the 194 countries, many of which have disputes with their neighbors. And they find different ways of dealing with it rather than just capturing their neighbor's country or portions of it to fulfill. So I agree with you. It hasn't always worked. And certainly the veto power at the Security Council has prevented the implementation in an objective way across the board. But this is where the population, if the governments don't work, the ordinary population can influence things through things like BDS.
Okay, Jonathan, I'm just about out of time, but Kim, final thoughts. Go ahead, please.
We do run into enforcement, and there is a need for an international campaign to enforce the rule of law. And that means that the campaign must be increased in intensity, persuading these countries that made the application at the ICJ for the opinion to also apply immediate sanctions against the criminal regime. As the Yemeni state has done in Sana'a, the parliament has passed sanctions against rogue regimes and its personnel. And also it's enforcing the rules by imposing economic sanctions on Israeli-bound ships. By the way, there are thousands of ships passing unhindered. Only Israeli, UK, and US are being obstructed simply because they are aiding and abetting and committing genocide. And that's a very serious crime. And the state of Yemen takes that very seriously and in compliance. Well, by the way, Yemen was one of the very first members of the UN when it was established.
I'm so sorry, but we...
enforcing the rule of law.
We're out of time. I thank you both for being with us. Jonathan Kotob, international lawyer out of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Kim Sheriff, activist and lawyer out of London. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. Goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll discuss some of the contents of chapter Naml, the 27th chapter of the Holy Quran, as well as some of the commentary points of the verses. Dear listeners, let's listen to the fourth and fifth verses of the chapter.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم إن الذين لا يؤمنون بالآخرة زينا لهم أعمالهم فهم يعمهون.
Indeed, for those who do not believe in the hereafter, we have made pleasing to them their deeds, so they wander blindly.
أولئك الذين لهم سوء العذاب وهم في الآخرة هم الأخسرون.
Those are the ones for whom there will be the worst of punishment, and in the hereafter they are the greatest losers.
إن الذين لا يؤمنون بالآخرة زَيَّنَّا لَهُمْ أَعْمَالَهُمْ فَهُمْ يَعْمَهُونَ. Verily, those who do not believe in hereafter, we have made their ugly deeds fair-seeming unto them, so they wander bewildered. أُولَٰئِكَ الَّذِينَ لَهُمْ سُوءُ الْعَذَابِ. These are those for whom shall be a grievous chastisement. وَهُمْ فِي الْآخِرَةِ هُمُ الْأَخْسَرُونَ. And in hereafter, they shall be the greatest losers. And we discussed thoroughly in the previous episode what the meaning of great loser, the greatest loser, is. And it is really important. What a loss is greater than the one who considers his ugly deeds beautiful? He does his best to make them practical, and yet he thinks he is doing a positive thing, but at the end he sees nothing but misery and chastisement. So, in the previous episode, we mentioned that there are different groups, losers. We have khasir, which is the one whose life and capital is lost. We have the one who is in loss, which is the one who is not a true believer and does not do righteous deeds, which One of the chapters of the Holy Quran says, وَالْعَصْرِ إِنَّ الْإِنسَانَ لَفِي خُسْرِ. By time, surely man is in loss. And why is that? It doesn't explain. But there are some people who are exempted from this. There are some people who are not in loss. And who are those people? Save those people who believe and do good deeds. We also have some people who are in state of clear loss. Those who worship Allah not earnestly. The Holy Quran says, so that if such a one who worships Allah only by tongue, so that if good befalls him, he is satisfied therewith. And if a trial afflicts him, he turns back his face. He loses his world and also the hereafter. That is indeed the manifest loss, the Quran says. And also the utmost loser, who is the most deviated, who is thinking that he's on the right path. Those whose effort is lost in this world's life while they think they are working good deeds. الَّذِينَ ضَلَّ سَعْيُهُمْ فِي الْحَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا وَهُمْ يَحْسَبُونَ أَنَّهُمْ يُحْسِنُونَ صُنْعًا. So, some Islamic traditions actually indicate that the losers are those who do not pay alms, which is zakat, persist on committing sins, and have the power of saying the right, but they do not do so. These are the most unjust ones, because they want to improve their worldly life by spoiling the religion. على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا. We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
Brothers and sisters, having a look at our traditions regarding losers, we stumble upon different explanations regarding that. For example, the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam has said, the loser is the one whose yearning is for other than Allah. And a loser is the one who neglects improving the affairs of his resurrection. Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam has said, he who has reckoned his own self has gained, and he who has neglected it has lost. He continues, how much a loser is he who has no good share in hereafter? The utmost loser among people is he who has the ability of saying the truth, but he does not say. Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam once wrote a letter to one of the companions who was the governor of Iran at the moment, and he says, I have come to know concerning you a matter which if you have done it, you have displeased your Allah and disobeyed your Imam. You are distributing among the Arabs of your kin who extend towards you the property of Muslims, which they collected by dint of their spears and horses, and on which their blood was shed, and do not reform your world by ruining your religion, since you will be from among the losers by that way. So this is what Imam Ali alayhi salam told to him and introduced him that if he continued doing this among the losers. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry ends when faith begins.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن می‌کند.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Imam Khomeini's historic speech outlining the state of affairs of the course of the revolution. Date January 23, 1983. Topic: Importance of propagating Islamic culture. Today, the superpowers have been given a slap by our Islamic revolution, and they are afraid lest in other parts other revolutions like ours take place. They are nervous, and every day design a new plot. We too must be prepared to counter them. In the same way that America is prepared to hatch plots, we too must be prepared to counter and confront them.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. About purging the self, Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh said, "It is impossible to learn the book and wisdom in the absence of purging the self. We should purify ourselves from all sorts of impurities, including inner desires and selfishness." This sentence of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayh concerns self-purification and its beneficial effects on the self. From the point of view of Islamic teachings, every sin leaves a black stain, and the effects of distortion in the human heart, which in turn weakens a person's aptitude for good and righteous actions, and consequently further deviates him towards other sins and foul deeds. On the other hand, worship, prayer, remembrance of God develop a human being's religious consciousness and strengthens their aptitude for virtuous deeds and diminish his will to do sins. This means that worship and remembrance of God efface the mal effects of sins and replace these with fondness for virtue and goodness. In Nahj al-Balagha, which is the famous book of Amir al-Mu'minin Ali alayhi salam, there is a sermon which deals with salah, zakat, and delivering of trust. After emphasizing the importance of salah, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Certainly prayer removes sins like autumn strips leaves from trees, and it liberates you from the rope of sins tied around your neck." The Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam linked it to a refreshing stream at one's door in which one takes a purifying bath 5 times in a day and night. During the journey of struggle against the self, one should constantly remember Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the graces bestowed by Him. He must at each step thank Him constantly for His help, mercy, and guidance in fulfilling His intentions. The degree of gratitude to God should increase as he attains a higher stage in his struggle against the self. He must realize that it was because of Allah's help and response to sincere prayers that he was able to get rid of Satan and his allies from the domain of his heart and attain sublime human attributes loved by God. You see, that is how our great Imam Rahmatullah Alayh advised us to purify our souls in order to reach wisdom and knowledge. Thank you very much for listening to this episode. I really wish that you have enjoyed it. And until another one, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Repair operations in the final stages. This is the main distribution pipeline passing through Iran's southwestern province of Charmahal and Bakhtiari, responsible for delivering natural gas to the northern provinces of Iran. Part of the main pipeline hit by 2 explosions on February 14. Clearly, the saboteurs had picked this remote location, hoping that it would result in delayed emergency response, leading to vast natural gas outages in the country. An obvious miscalculation, as the National Iranian Gas Company, NIGC, had its local technicians and first responders on site in less than 10 minutes. The tall flames resulting from the overnight explosion could be seen from miles away.
The explosion was immense, creating a huge fire that burned and melted everything on its way 300 meters away.
Power cables were damaged. The local electricity distribution company immediately diverted to other connected paths to prevent power outages. And within minutes, local NIGC technicians arrived.
As a result of great teamwork, we were able to contain the fire in less than 5 hours, and we completed our repair operation within 44 hours, which can be considered a record. It is important to note that our local technicians were able to quickly bring the situation under control without any help from nearby provinces. That is why there were no disruptions in gas supplies.
As a result of the NIGC's agile response, the sabotage attack did not lead to any natural gas outages.
So the pipe that was damaged by the explosion, a pipe that would carry 70 million cubic meters of natural gas in 24 hours.
The NIGC had two separate alternative options. So as a first step, technicians simply cut gas flow through this pipe, which allowed the first responders to contain the fire in less than 5 hours.
Throughout the year, we carry out several simulation exercises with different scenarios to enhance our response plans and procedures for all kinds of hazards. That is why our team is always prepared for emergencies, and in this case, they knew exactly what to do according to our crisis management plan.
With the damaged pipe replaced with a new one, everything is back to normal.
This heavily damaged 42-inch pipe that you see right behind me is part of the main pipeline that takes natural gas from the south of Iran towards the north. However, the NIGC did have a plan B, and therefore the explosion did not disrupt gas supplies.
Officials detailed that because the fire sparked in an unpopulated area, the spread of the flames was manageable for the responding firefighters. There were no casualties and only limited material damage. And since the flow of heat and cooking gas to the northern provinces was not disrupted, as far as consumers were concerned, basically nothing happened. Simply a foiled attempt, with Iranians now more confident than ever in the capabilities of NIGC technicians. Gisumish Ahmadi, Boruchen.
No picket lines over the weekend, but the strike action is on. Thousands of National Health Service junior doctors, who form half of the doctors' workforce in England, walk off the job. Their demands the same as the last time we talked to them.
Because of this erosion of pay over all this time, we've been seeing problems with staff recruitment and retention, and we've been hemorrhaging people either out of medicine completely or to other countries that are willing to recruit us and pay us basically the rates we were being paid 15 years ago. And so the message from the BMA has always been to try and get that pay back to 2008 levels.
In other words, a 35% pay rise to make up for previous below-inflation pay rises. An extra 3% on top of the average of nearly 9% received last year was being discussed before talks between the government and the BMA, the trade union for doctors, broke down in December. But the walkouts come at a cost. They're happening at a critical time of year when hospitals are especially busy dealing with the challenges of the cold season and with an NHS waiting list at a staggering 7.6 million. Over 1.3 million hospital appointments had to be rescheduled since the industrial action began over a year ago. And yet, the striking doctors continue to enjoy the support of over half of Britons.
The doctors say they're doing this to bring the government back to the negotiating table and to get it to recognize their value. They're also saying that feeling undervalued and being underpaid is pushing them to seek jobs abroad.
The BMA says 4 in 10 doctors plan to leave the NHS at the first opportunity. The government says it won't negotiate while the strikes are ongoing.
There's an overall focus on privatization, which means the health care insurance companies will be taking over many aspects of the running and resources of health. And that's led to record low wages, especially compared to a massive inflation and cost of living crisis, so that it no longer justifies the cost of training. In terms of the actual remuneration, medical students are leaving with medical school with £100,000 worth of debt, and they're not looking to pay that off for well over a decade. Whereas if they go to other countries, simply next door, Ireland or Australia, they can immediately double their wage.
The British government seems nowhere near loosening its purse strings. But the consensus is that the longer these strikes grind on, the wider the damage. Saipur is up, London.
The summit of ECOWAS leaders, which ended in Abuja, the Nigerian capital, resolved that closure of air and land borders between ECOWAS countries and Niger is to be lifted in addition to other sanctions.
No-fly zone of all commercial flights to and from Niger is to be lifted. Suspension of all commercial and financial transactions between ECOWAS member states and Niger is to be lifted. Freezing of all service transactions, including utility services, is to be lifted. Freezing of assets of the Republic of Niger in ECOWAS central banks is to be lifted.
However, the ECOWAS meeting called for the ruling authority in Niger to provide an acceptable transition timetable to constitutional order. The ECOWAS leader said the decision to lift the sanctions was based on humanitarian considerations, especially as people are in the month of Lent and the holy month of Ramadan approaches. The meeting asked the three countries that exited the ECOWAS, that are Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, to reconsider the decisions in view of the benefits the countries and their citizens enjoy in the regional bloc, especially the hundreds of millions of dollars of projects and programs, notably the Food Security Reserve. The ECOWAS leaders therefore urged the three member states that exited the regional body to resort to dialogue, negotiation, and mediation to address their concerns.
The authority has also instructed the president of the commission to invite Burkina Faso, Niger, Mali, and Guinea to attend the technical and consultative meetings of ECOWAS, as well as all security-related meetings.
The three West African countries exited the ECOWAS and established what they called the Sahel Alliance after ECOWAS resolved to condemn the military coups in the three countries and to impose sanctions on them. Experts believe that there are solutions in the medium and long terms for solving the crisis in the regional economic body.
The issues I mentioned earlier of pan-Africanism, of resource nationalism, of ensuring that people are carried along in decision-making processes, of ensuring that there is equitable distribution of resources, of ensuring that people have access to the good things of life, of ensuring that the dividends of governance is brought to the people, must be addressed.
As one of the least developed regions in the world, the Sahel faces a multitude of challenges, including poverty, food security, poor governance and insecurity. Experts say some of these challenges are a matter of great concern, not just for the Sahel, but for the whole of Africa and beyond. They also noted that skillful diplomacy must be employed in addressing the exit of the three West African regions from the ECOWAS. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Iran Zamzam's company is poised to replace two major international soft drink brands in the region, driven by a growing boycott sentiment against Israeli army-associated products following the Gaza conflict. Having already entered markets in Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, and the UAE, the company aims to export 4 million cans of its popular soda to Kuwait, making a significant milestone in its expansion efforts.
My concept revolved around organizing a festival exclusively showcasing Iranian products. However, following the conflict in Gaza and the overwhelming positive feedback we received, we expanded our vision to encompass Turkish and Kuwaiti products as well. The event is spanned 2 months, during which we received numerous requests for an extension. Our primary objective at the society remains to spotlight Iranian, Kuwaiti, and Turkish goods, particularly as consumers are actively seeking alternatives to products associated with Israel.
Zamzam's growth in the Persian Gulf soft drink market is reinforced by its official replacement status for soda drinks in Kuwait alongside local brands like LC and Kenzo. The Iranian-Turkish festival organized by the biggest societies in Kuwait, Al Jabriya, has been instrumental in promoting Zamzam and other locally made alternatives as primary substitutes for boycotted products, significantly boosting Zamzam's popularity and market presence in Kuwait.
We're also operating as a retail seller, catering to the demand for products from Iran, Turkey and Kuwait, which many customers have been requesting. While we understand that implementing boycotts can be challenging to achieve rapidly, it's not unattainable. Therefore, in response to the tragic events in Gaza, we've completely redirected our focus towards promoting locally made products through a campaign titled Support Us Twice. The response has been phenomenal, with our sales soaring. Moreover, numerous other societies in Kuwait have chosen to follow suit and advocate exclusively for Iranian, Turkish, and locally produced goods.
The shift in consumer preference toward locally produced alternatives like Zamzam is emblematic of the broader economic repercussions of the conflict in Gaza. Major multinational corporations, including Starbucks, McDonald's, and Pepsi-Cola, have experienced a significant decline in sales as consumers increasingly opt for products that align with their values and principles. As Zamzam continues to expand its footprint in the GCC countries, particularly in Kuwait, there is a shift in consumer behavior toward more regional products, and particularly the one from Iran, from other GCC countries, which is why the public in Kuwait is shifting into buying more products that are not associated in any way possible with the United States or Britain. This is Farah Al-Hashim, Kuwait City, from Al Jabriya area.
As the Pakistan Super League kicks off for its highly anticipated cricket matches, an unexpected controversy has emerged, leading to widespread calls for a boycott among Pakistani fans.
Oh, that is clear of all fielders.
The uproar stems from KFC's association as a sponsor of the tournament, with critics citing the fast food chain's American roots and linking it to the United States' support for Israel's onslaught on Gaza.
We condemn KFC as a sponsor of our national cricket event. KFC represents a company with ties to Israel. Israel is involved in the killing of thousands of innocent men, women, and children in Gaza.
Meanwhile, activists are pushing to boycott the event, urging fellow Pakistanis to refrain from attending matches in person and instead watch the games online from the comfort of their homes. The move not only expresses dissent, but also hits the tournament organizers where it hurts the most, their ticket sales and on-ground merchandise purchases.
I am part of the boycott movement because I believe it's important to stand up for the people of Gaza. By watching online, I am not contributing to the ticket sales or on the on-ground merchandise purchases, which are the main sources of revenue for the organizers. It's a way of hitting them where it hurts.
Usually we would go to the ground, but this year I think a lot of even cricket fanatics have chosen not to just because they want to boycott KFC as their main sponsor. But me personally, I've been skipping a lot of matches as well. We need to show solidarity for Gaza and stick with our brothers and sisters. I think that's more important.
Social media platforms have been flooded with hashtags such as hashtag boycott PSL and hashtag no to KFC as disillusioned fans express their discontent over what they perceive as an endorsement of American policies that they vehemently oppose.
The widespread boycott of an international cricket tournament by the passionate cricket-loving nation of Pakistan not only signals solidarity with the people of Gaza, but also serves as a powerful expression of discontent towards the businesses associated with the U.S. and Israel. Nasik Azmi, Islamabad.
In yet another rally to support the Palestinians in Gaza Strip, thousands of Yemenis have filled the streets of the capital Sana'a and other major cities. They chanted slogans supporting Palestinian resistance and condemned the Arab world's indifference toward Israeli atrocities in Gaza.
The Yemeni people were raised since their childhood to love and adore Palestine and to love jihad in Palestine. Therefore, when the opportunity arose to have an influential position under the leadership of Ansarullah, they did not hesitate and went out to the streets, believing that their protests were jihad for the sake of God, as the least duty as long as the borders were not opened for them, and they were not able to fight with the Palestinians.
A message to the European peoples. Your governments today are contributing to genocide against the Palestinian people in Gaza by submitting to America's orders to militarize the Red Sea. America involves you in its own problems. The solution to stopping the Red Sea operations is to stop the aggression against Gaza and lift the siege. This is the easiest solution. But if your government wants to submit to America's orders, you will see what we will teach. You will see that we will teach America a lesson that will